Welcome to this special edition of the Oncology Peer Review On The Go podcast. I'm your host, Matthew Fowler. As part of our OncView video series, Cancer Network spoke with Connie Botlevy, a medical oncologist at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. She discussed updates in therapies for relapsed or refractory follicular lymphoma, as well as discussing the current treatment options for this disease, third-line therapies, tazemetostat, and different sequencing changes. Take a listen.
So, Dr. Botlevy, how many patients relapse after frontline therapy?
So, first off, thank you for having me. Follicular lymphoma is considered a non-curable indolent lymphoma. The goals of any treatment are to balance effectiveness of treatment as well as the quality of life, cost of care during each treatment decision. In some of our longitudinal studies, about 50% of patients relapse after frontline therapy over a decade of observation. However, as patients are thankfully living beyond a decade, we know that patients are ultimately always at risk for a relapse.
Okay. And so what are the treatment goals in the relapsed or refractory setting?
So the selection of treatment at first relapse is dependent on multiple parameters, such as a patient's functional status, the characteristics of their relapse, their prior treatments, their prior response, and their duration of response to treatment. There are a lot of different treatments, but they can be chemotherapy with a CD20-directed antibody, CD20 antibodies by themselves, lenalidomide-based treatments, or even local therapy with radiation.
Okay. And what has been the impact of new treatment options on the overall treatment landscape?
So new treatments in follicular lymphoma are a very exciting component of drug development in the space. Over the last several decades, we see that the overall survival and progression-free survival are improving over time with follicular lymphoma. I can only assume that this is partially as a result of the many treatment options that we have developed for this lymphoma subtype.
What factors do you consider when choosing treatment for first relapse in a relapse or refractory follicular lymphoma patient?
So there's a variety of parameters to help us guide treatment selection at the first relapse. First, a patient's functional status, which is independent of their disease status, guides what one may offer. In the clinic, I may be looking at how a patient walks into a room, or I ask about their level of independence at home. Mm-hmm. Next, I evaluate the characteristics of their relapse, the volume of their disease based on imaging, the impact on blood counts based on blood work, metabolic activity as determined by a PET scan, and genetic and sort of pathologic features of their disease, like a high Ki-67 or certain genetic features. A biopsy is almost always an important aspect of disease assessment because these are key to identifying a transformation. And a transformation is where the follicular lymphoma changes to a diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. If a transformation were to occur, that would change the management. Then I kind of weigh their prior treatments and their response to treatment in order to guide that first relapse treatment.
Okay. And so for each treatment option, is there a preferred patient type for each one?
In many ways, patients are able to receive a lot of different types of treatments, but it's kind of based on all of those other things that we talked about. So broadly speaking, you know, if we gave CHOP-based chemotherapy for somebody in the frontline setting, we probably would not give CHOP-based therapy again in this first relapse. Mm-hmm. Similarly, if they got bendamustine in the first round, then they may not get it in the second round. We have to balance out the side effects of each of those chemotherapy regimens, as well as the duration of those chemotherapy regimens in order to select it. And then, you know, there's always immune-based target therapies like lenalidomide, but often those are longer durations of treatments, and we have to factor in their each individual patient's lifestyle as well. For the truly frail patients, yes, we can make those guides, very broad sort of aspects where maybe they should get a single agent anti-CD20 antibody or localized therapy or tazemetostat, which is approved to serve in this setting. I think another segue into this is how do we actually time that treatment? Because just because a patient relapses doesn't always mean that they require treatment. Mm-hmm. So in the frontline setting, we use criteria like GELF criteria. This is a set of clinical criteria that was sort of validated to guide frontline treatment of follicular lymphoma. Those criteria include having more than 3 lymph nodes that are more than 3 centimeters, any one lymph node more than 7 centimeters, or if there's any effect of the lymph nodes on any critical organs or impact on blood counts, et cetera. While I kind of use those parameters for subsequent lines of therapy, it's sort of a guide and less so a mandate. So I keep it in consideration when deciding which patients in this relapse setting needs observation or treatment.
And so how does treatment choice after first relapse impact treatment options in later lines?
Yeah, I guess very simply, we don't commonly repeat treatments because there's so many different types of treatments, and repeated exposure can either increase your toxicity or you know, the lymphomas can develop resistance to the prior treatments. We don't ever really say never, but that's a general concept.
Okay. And what clinical endpoints are most meaningful to you?
The meaning really changes depending on the patient. For example, if I have a 60-something-year-old patient who's still working hard in his career, but his follicular lymphoma keeps coming back to interrupt his life, what's meaningful to him is to have a very effective form of treatment to get his disease under control. Mm-hmm. In contrast, if I have an octogenarian who has zero tolerance for any treatment that can create symptoms, can be quite fragile, the goal for this treatment is to have some disease control and some symptom control while maximizing how tolerable a treatment may be.
What are the treatments that are available for the third line or for relapsed or refractory follicular lymphoma?
So there are so many treatments available for third line and beyond. Mentally, I classify treatments into chemotherapy versus non-chemotherapy options first. Classically, any chemotherapy remains an option, though it's not likely going to be sort of the forefront of our resources. Mm-hmm. In the same chemotherapy concept, there are autologous stem cell transplant, which is really high doses of chemotherapy. Mm-hmm. So in terms of the non-chemotherapy options, they fall into different classes like PI3 kinase inhibitors, EZH2 inhibitors, immune-based therapies like CAR T cells, and then also an allogeneic stem cell, which is essentially an immune replacement therapy to control follicular lymphoma.
Okay. And are treatment goals for third line and beyond the same as the second line setting?
No, this is also a very much an individualized plan. And probably why taking care of follicular lymphoma patients can be so gratifying. You know, by this time, you've kind of understood that person's life goals and what their short-term and long-term goals are. And depending on their disease course with the lymphoma and their life goals, the treatments can really, the treatment recommendations can vary. Mm-hmm. You know, as an example, I have a patient who recently retired and has been living with follicular lymphoma for over 15 years. He even was successfully treated for a second cancer, not related to the lymphoma. Mm-hmm. So with the last relapse, you know, he had localized disease that was in a radiation field. So we made radiation a part of his treatment. Mm-hmm. in another patient. He's a farmer who lives very, very far away from me. His disease keeps coming back, but it's not transformed. We biopsy to prove that. And it's also not very extensive, not very bulky. It's not impeding his function. He progressed after a couple of different treatments, including PI3 kinase inhibitors. Mm-hmm. And, you know, unless he was up for coming to Manhattan and really spending some time getting his disease controlled at a major city or a major academic center, he really didn't have so many choices. So we sequenced him, and even though his lymphoma didn't have an EZH2 mutation, we just gave it a try to try tazemetostat, and thus far he's been doing great. And that has given him, from what I hear, very limited side effects, if any, and he also doesn't have to drive into the city to see me.
Absolutely. And so when it comes to treatment for the third line setting and beyond, how important is molecular testing?
Yeah, so I strongly believe in molecular testing for lymphomas in general, and particularly for follicular lymphoma. EZH2 inhibition is the first molecularly targeted treatment in all of lymphoma. So sort of being able to interpret and have that additional information can really help guide you. You know, as I mentioned, I didn't use, I used tazemetostat on EZH2 wild type patients. And it's because we know that about 70% of follicular lymphoma have inherent genetic features that are regulated by epigenetics. And tazemetostat is a drug that regulates the epigenomics in a patient. Mm-hmm. So the response rates are lower, but when they do respond, patients can respond for a good amount of time.
Can you also discuss the recent approval of tazemetostat and kind of the study design and what this means for this patient population?
Yeah, so tazemetostat is an EZH2 inhibitor. EZH2 is what we call a histone methyltransferase, and their function is to wind and unwind the DNA to sort of control how oncogenes, genes that drive cancers, are either expressed or not expressed. EZH2 is very important for B cell development. Germinal center B cells need this sort of control to decide to grow or to not exit from the germinal center. So it's involved in sort of the immune signals and the terminal differentiation of these cells. Mm-hmm. EZH2 mutations happens in about 15 to 25% of follicular lymphoma. And the mutation basically enhances this activity of the methyltransferase so that it adds on a third methyl group. Mm-hmm. So tazemetostat is an inhibitor of this. And when they did the phase 2 clinical trial that led to its approval, we looked at two groups of patients. Patients that are EZH2 mutated and patients that are EZH2 wild type. The patients had to have two or more prior therapies. The drug was given 800 milligrams twice a day orally. We did see responses in both. There was a heightened sensitivity to the response in EZH2 mutant patients. In the mutant patients, the overall response rate was about 70%. And in wild type, it was about 35%. But in either group, about 20% of the patients, there's a durability of this response beyond 18 months. Hmm. You know, furthermore, the drug has a very favorable safety profile. I think less than 5% of patients discontinued therapy, less than 10% required a dose reduction. The most common side effects were some nausea, diarrhea, thinning of the hair that is not total hair loss, and some fatigue. And even though, you know, all grade events were common, adverse events that were grade 3 or more really represented just 5% of the population. When the tazemetostat received FDA approval, it was approved in patients with relapsed or refractory follicular lymphoma who had an EZH2 mutation and they had at least two prior treatments in the past. In addition, they also approved the drug in patients who had relapsed or refractory disease who didn't really have satisfactory treatment options, either based on sort of side effect profiles, comorbidities, or sort of the types of preferences that the patient had.
And what are the implications of this approval on the treatment landscape?
So in terms of this treatment approval, we have to keep in mind that this becomes one of the first targeted therapies for follicular lymphoma. And this will open up new doors in terms of how we can use genetic profiling in personalized medicine to develop more treatments in lymphoma. Mm-hmm. In terms of this particular drug, because of its very favorable safety profile, there are ongoing clinical trials to test this in combination with other treatments. There are clinical trials studying addition of rituximab with tazemetostat. This makes sense because at least in non-human models in the laboratory, they showed that there was some synergism to the addition of the two. Similarly, there is a clinical trial with the combination of rituximab, lenalidomide, and tazemetostat in the second line setting. There's also going to be broadening of tazemetostat in the upfront setting. And there has been existing trials which studied the combination of this with R-CHOP to see if there was any adverse sort of or any additional side effect profiles that we missed. And so far, the performance in terms of the side effect profile has been quite satisfactory.
Great. And what factors do you consider when choosing a treatment option for each patient?
Oh, goodness. as we sort of discussed before, it's really patient dependent, depending on all of the parameters that make them. Their functional status, their social support system, the types of treatment that they have had in the past, and sort of how robust they are to get treatment now, what the pace of their disease is as they are entering treatment. It is not a one size fit all scenario, and I think it's hard to individualize or make blanket treatment decisions.
Absolutely. And can you discuss the role of PI3K kinase inhibitors for relapse or refractory follicular lymphoma in the third line or later?
Sure. We have four FDA-approved PI3 kinase inhibitors for follicular lymphoma in the third line or beyond. There's idelalisib, duvelisib, copanlisib, and umbralisib. Each targets slightly different PI3 kinase isoforms. For example, idelalisib targets gamma delta, duvelisib the same. Copanlisib is a pan-3K PI3 kinase inhibitor, and umbralisib is a delta and CK1 epsilon targeter. So in general, responses are in the 50% range and CRs are typically less than 10%. There are some side effect profiles that is pertinent for the earlier generation PI3 kinase inhibitors. For example, idelalisib, duvelisib, they have a risk of colitis and pneumonitis that can affect our patients. Copanlisib, perhaps with the mechanism of how it's given, which is intravenously approximately once a week, they are able to have less of those colitis and pneumonitis events, but they also see the alpha isoform side effects, such as hyperglycemia and hypertension. Umbralisib is a little bit similar in that it is sort of the new PI3 kinase that's available, and the side effect profile seems to be a little bit more tolerated, but overall there's fewer patients on it so far, so we just need to sort of see how it evolves.
Given the COVID-19 pandemic, but then also the addition of these newer therapies, how has your sequencing of therapy changed over the last year?
Mm-hmm. So in the past, you know, we know that there is strong data regarding CD20-based maintenance therapy in terms of improving progression-free survival, but not overall survival. It remains a decision as to whether to utilize that maintenance or not. I think COVID has impacted that in the sense that you know, continuous CD20 based treatment effectively reduces the effectiveness of any vaccination. Mm-hmm. And CD20 maintenance therapy lasts typically about 2 years. So maintenance therapy in this vein is a little bit challenging to recommend broadly for all patients, mm-hmm. in particular in patients who achieve a complete remission. It becomes more of a discussion for patients that don't achieve a complete remission or truly demonstrate that they need this kind of maintenance therapy. So we kind of end up tailoring our maintenance therapy discussions even more. Mm-hmm. And in terms of the availability of newer therapies, I think that, again, it truly depends on sort of the goals of those individual patient. You know, when we talk about some of these target therapies, it is typically indefinite therapy, whereas regimens like R-CHOP or R-bendamustine, they have a finite amount of time. But, you know, you are sort of gaining other sort of non-chemo related benefits. So we end up talking more about how we select each item or each treatment as it relates to that person.
Great. What has been your experience with tazemetostat?
So tazemetostat is a very easy to administer drug. It's an 800 milligram twice a day drug that patients take by mouth. It's 200 milligram pills, so it's 4 pills. Twice a day. The side effect profiles are really easy to manage. There's no substantial sort of neutropenias or leukopenias are concerning, especially in this sort of pandemic setting. In terms of what we use it for, you know, in the approved setting, it's primarily for patients in the relapse setting. If they have an EZH2 mutation, it makes a lot of sense to do it. It would mean that you have to test EZH2 mutation status. If they don't have an EZH2 mutation, I've been using it in patients who tend to be a little bit more frail. And by frail, I mean as they can't get any aggressive therapies. They're not truly eligible for autologous stem cell transplants or allogeneic stem cell transplants or CAR T cell type treatments.
Okay. And so what are you looking forward to during this upcoming ASH annual meeting?
Well, I'm looking forward to the immune therapy data in both large cell lymphoma and follicular lymphoma. CAR T cells and bispecifics are important for this patient population in the earlier lines of therapy and also in sort of the patients who have a higher risk of disease. Both of the second line data for CAR T cells in diffuse large B cell lymphoma will be exciting material to monitor. Bispecific specifically should have data in follicular lymphoma. And those are an exciting class of agents that is immune based and may have a high impact in follicular lymphoma. I will also be presenting our data on the rituximab, lenalidomide, and tazemetostat combination for second-line follicular lymphoma.
Great. Well, thank you so much.
Don't forget to subscribe to the Oncology Peer Review On The Go podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Or you can listen online at cancernetwork.com/resources/podcasts. The Oncology Peer Review On The Go podcast is the official podcast of Cancer Network, the home of the journal Oncology. For more information, visit us at cancernetwork.com and find us on Twitter at Cancer Network without the O or on Facebook and LinkedIn at Cancer Network. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you again next time.